When, in 1941, the Saturday Evening Post assigned Jack Alexander to scout AA for a feature story, we had already learned our lesson. Therefore, nothing was left to chance. Had Jack been able to get to St. Louis for the convention, he himself could have told how skeptical he had been of this assignment. He had just finished doing a piece on the Jersey rackets, and he didn't believe anybody on a stack of Bibles a mile high. After Jack checked in with us at headquarters, we took him in tow for nearly a whole month. In order to write his powerful article, he had to have our fullest attention and carefully organized help. We gave him our records, opened the books, introduced him to non-alcoholic trustees, fixed up interviews with AAs of every description, and finally showed him the AA sites from New York and Philadelphia all the way to Chicago via Akron and Cleveland. Although he was not an alcoholic, Jack soon became a true AA convert in spirit. When at last he sat down at his typewriter, his heart was in it. He was no longer on the outside of AA looking in. He was really inside looking out. As soon as the article appeared, 6,000 frantic inquiries hit our New York post office. Jack's piece made Alcoholics Anonymous a national institution, and it also made him one of our greatest friends and, finally, one of our trustees. The kind of help we gave Jack Alexander, our organized service of public information, is the vital ingredient in our public relations that most AAs have never seen. But in the St. Louis press room, the visitors did see one aspect of it, working this time for the convention itself. There sat AA's Ralph, handling our contacts with the press. He was surrounded by phones, typewriters, piles of releases, clip sheets, telegrams in and out, all the gadgets of his trade. Now, what was he doing and why? Could this be a ballyhooed promotion stunt? Something quite contrary to AA traditions? Not a bit of it. Ralph was handling this job simply to help our friends of press, radio, and television. The whole world wanted to know about our 20th anniversary. Newspapers and magazines wanted interviews and press releases. Radio and television broadcasters wanted to arrange for interviews. People wanted us to explain what we meant when we said that AA had come of age. Our friends in AA and millions outside wanted to read and hear and see, and it was certainly up to us to help. It was not always a question of our communicating with them. Lots of them wanted to communicate with us, especially alcoholics and families who were still suffering. The City Fathers of St. Louis sent their warmest congratulations, and this reminded us of their generosity in giving the use of the Kiel Auditorium free of charge. We were further reminded of the wonderful cordiality of the local groups in town, the hospitable clubs, and the many parties. Telegrams came to us in the Kiel Auditorium from AA people and groups everywhere. One of the brightest highlights of the convention appeared in this message. Dateline, the White House. Sender, the President of the United States. Please convey to all who participate in your 20th anniversary gathering my good wishes for a successful meeting. Your society's record of growth and service is an inspiration to those who, through research, perseverance, and faith, move forward to the solution of many serious personal and public health problems. Dwight D. Eisenhower. When this telegram was read to the convention, we experienced great elation mixed with deep humility. AA had indeed come of age. In the eyes of the world, we had now become full and responsible citizens once more. The last day of the convention moved from morning crescendo to afternoon climax. At 11:30 a.m., we began the meeting, God as we understand Him. Deep silence fell as Dr. Jim S., the AA speaker, told of his life experience and the serious drinking that led to the crisis which had brought about his spiritual awakening. He reenacted for us his struggle to start the very first group among Negroes, his own people. Aided by a tireless and eager wife, He had turned his home into a combined hospital and AA meeting place, free to all. As he told how early failure had finally been transformed under God's grace into amazing success, we who listened realized that AA not only could cross seas and mountains and boundaries of language and nation, but could surmount obstacles of race and creed as well. A great cheer of welcome greeted Father Ed Dowling, as, indifferent to his grievous lameness, he made his way to the lectern. Father Dowling, of the Jesuit order in St. Louis, is intimately known to AAs for 1,000 miles and more around. Many in the convention audience remembered with gratitude his ministry to their spiritual needs. St. Louis old-timers recalled how he helped start their group. It had turned out to be largely Protestant, but this fazed him not a bit. Some of us could remember his first piece about us in The Queen's Work, the Sodalities magazine. He had been the first to note how closely in principle AA's 12 steps paralleled a part of the exercises of St. Ignatius, a basic spiritual discipline of the Jesuit order. He had boldly written, in effect, to all alcoholics, and especially to those of his own faith, "Folks, AA is good. Come and get it." And this they certainly had done. His first written words were the beginning of a wonderfully benign influence in favor of our fellowship, the total of which no one will ever be able to compute. Father Ed's talk to us at the convention that Sunday morning flashed with humor and deep insight. As he spoke, the memory of his first appearance in my own life came back to me as fresh as though it were yesterday. One wintry night in 1940, in AA's old 24th Street Club in New York, I'd gone to bed at about 10 o'clock with a severe dose of self-pity and my imaginary ulcer. Lois was out somewhere. Hail and sleet beat on the tin roof over my head. It was a wild night. The club was deserted except for old Tom, the retired fireman, that diamond in the rough, lately salvaged from Rockland Asylum. The front doorbell clanged, and a moment later, Tom pushed open my bedroom door. "Some bum," said he, "from St. Louis is down there and wants to see you." "Oh, Lord," I said, "not another one. And at this time of night, oh, well, bring him up." I heard labored steps on the stairs. Then, balanced precariously on his cane, he came into the room, carrying a battered black hat that was shapeless as a cabbage leaf and plastered with sleet. He lowered himself into my solitary chair, and when he opened his overcoat, I saw his clerical collar. He brushed back a shock of white hair and looked at me through the most remarkable pair of eyes I have ever seen. We talked about a lot of things, and my spirits kept on rising. And presently I began to realize that this man radiated a grace that filled the room with a sense of presence. I felt this with great intensity. It was a moving and mysterious experience. In years since, I have seen much of this great friend, and whether I was in joy or in pain, he always brought to me the same sense of grace and the presence of God. My case is no exception. Many who meet Father Ed experience this touch of the eternal. It is no wonder that he was able to fill all of us there in the Kiel Auditorium with his inimitable spirit on that wonderful Sunday morning. There came next to the lectern a figure that not many AAs had seen before, the Episcopal clergyman Sam Shoemaker. It was from him that Dr. Bob and I, in the beginning, had absorbed most of the principles that were afterward embodied in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, steps that expressed the heart of AA's way of life. Dr. Silkworth gave us the needed knowledge of our illness, but Sam Shoemaker had given us the concrete knowledge of what we could do about it. One showed us the mysteries of the lock that held us in prison. The other passed on the spiritual keys by which we were liberated. Dr. Sam looked scarcely a day older than he had almost 21 years earlier when I first met him and his dynamic group at Calvary's Parish House in New York. As he began to speak, his impact fell upon us there in the Kiel Auditorium, just as it had upon Lois and me years before. As always, he called a spade, and his blazing eagerness, earnestness, and crystal clarity drove home his message point by point. With all his vigor and power of speech, Sam nevertheless kept himself right down to our size. Here was a man quite as willing to talk about his sins as about anybody else's. He made himself a witness of God's power and love, just as any AA might have done. Sam's appearance before us was further evidence that many a channel had been used by Providence to create Alcoholics Anonymous. And none had been more vitally needed than the one opened through Sam Shoemaker and his Oxford Group associates of a generation before. The basic principles which the Oxford Groupers had taught were ancient and universal ones, the common property of mankind. Certain of the former OG attitudes and applications had proved unsuited to AA's purpose, and Sam's own conviction about these lesser aspects of the Oxford Groups had later changed and become more like our AA views of today. But the important thing is this. The early AA got its ideas of self-examination, acknowledgement of character defects, restitution for harm done, and working with others straight from the Oxford Groups and directly from Sam Shoemaker, their former leader in America, and from nowhere else. He will always be found in our annals as the one who inspired example and teaching did most to show us how to create the spiritual climate in which we alcoholics may survive and then proceed to grow. AA owes a debt of timeless gratitude for all that God sent us through Sam and his friends in the days of AA's infancy. As we approached our last session, a number of great questions still remained in the collective mind of the convention. What would happen when AA's originators and old-timers had gone? Would AA continue to grow and prosper? Could we go on functioning as a whole, no matter what perils the future brought? Had AA really come to the age of full responsibility? Could members and groups worldwide now safely assume complete control and guidance of AA's principal affairs? Would AA now be able to take over from the old-timers, from Dr. Bob and from Bill? If so, by what agency and just how? For a long time, these questions had been asked anxiously, and for over 5 years, solutions for these problems had been eagerly sought, especially by old AA hands, people like myself, who must soon relinquish their 20 years' guardianship of AA and turn over their trust to the vast family now fully reared. The time had come for the answers. High in the great hall of the Kiel Auditorium, there hung a banner on which everyone could see the new symbol for Alcoholics Anonymous, the triangle within the circle. On the stage, far beneath the banner, at 4 o'clock on Sunday, our society was to be declared come of age, its elected service conference taking over the guardianship of our traditions and the custody of our world services, would then become the successor to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. The thousands of us were united in one spirit and in a great expectation as we sat waiting for the opening of this last meeting. What we thought and felt is hard to tell, hard especially for one person. It would help if someone could speak for all of us, and perhaps in a way this is possible. Each day at the convention I had spoken with many AAs, folks of every description and persuasion, plainsmen and mountain people, city dwellers and townsmen, workmen and businessmen, school teachers and professors, clergymen and doctors, ad men and journalists, artists and builders, clerks and bankers, socialites and skid rowers, career girls and housewives, people from other lands speaking in strange accents and tongues, Catholics and Protestants and Jews, and men and women of no religion. Of many of these people, I asked the same questions. What do you think of this convention? And what do you think of AA's future? Each, of course, reacted according to his or her own viewpoint. But I was astonished when I sensed the unanimity of feeling and opinion that ran through all. I felt and still feel this so strongly that I believe it may be permissible here to introduce a spokesman for the whole convention itself, a sort of composite character, who nevertheless may truly portray what practically everybody at St. Louis really saw, really heard, and really felt. Let's call our anonymous spokesman Mr. Grassroots. He hails from Centerville, USA, and this is what he has to say. I went to the Keel, says Mr. Grassroots, ahead of time for that last meeting. While I was waiting, I thought of all that had happened to me in 3 days. I come from the small town of Centerville. I was born and raised there, did my drinking, and got into my trouble there. I was about ready to throw in the sponge when AA came to town. Several years back, a traveling chap tossed us the idea, and since then, about a dozen of us alkies in Centerville have grabbed the lifeline. The groups in my state are pretty small and scattered, and so we do not see much of each other. We've never had a state get-together. Our Centerville group has been just about all of AA for me. Good AA, too. Of course, we've had the big book and some pamphlets and the grapevine, and now and then a traveler told us something about AA in other places. It was fine to know that other people like us were getting their chance, too. But our main interest was in each other and in the Centerville drunks that had not yet sobered up. The rest of AA seemed a long way off. There did not seem to be much that we could do about it anyhow, even if we wanted to. This was how it was with me before St. Louis. This convention has been a terrific experience. I ran into hundreds of AAs and their families charging around in the hotels. Then I saw thousands in the big auditorium. I am sort of shy, but I got over that. I got mixed in with people who were having the time of their lives, people who came from 500, 1,000, maybe 5,000 miles away, from places I'd only read about in the papers. Pretty soon I was telling them about AA in Centerville, rattling on as happy as anybody. These people were not strangers to me at all. It seems as if I had known and trusted and loved them all my life. I had felt that way about my AA group at home, but now I felt the same way about every AA and all of AA. I can't tell you what this meant. To me, it was big. This was real brotherhood. These were my people, my kin and my kind. I belonged to them, and they belonged to me. Every barrier, every thought of race, creed, or nationality dropped out of my mind. This tremendous thing happened to me in only a few hours. I took in every meeting I could. I heard those doctors tell how much their profession was for us. I went to an Al-Anon meeting and realized for the first time that AA is for the whole family, too. The sessions on prisons and mental institutions convinced me that as a drinker, I'd been a piker, and that almost no alcoholic disaster was too tough for AA to help. At other meetings, I saw that AA had been facing and solving a lot of problems I never knew we had. Problems in the big cities and all over the world. I saw that we still had plenty wrong with us as a fellowship, but I was sure that our present troubles would iron out as well as the others had. On Friday night, I heard how AA started. How many people, non-alcoholic friends as well as ourselves, had been required to do the job, at how many points we could have run off the road for a complete smash-up, yet how we had never yet overskidded a curve or failed to take the right turn. The hand of a higher power had been on the wheel all the time. On Saturday night, I felt like getting worried all over again, as Bill told us how he and Dr. Bob had wondered all the way from 1939 to 1945 if AA was going to hang together after all. What with the troubles of members, groups, and new beginnings in foreign countries? I got a jolt when I heard that the AA book and the New York headquarters had once been the source of the most hair-raising squabbles of all. Maybe this kind of thing could get going again someday. But I calmed down when it was made clear that all this old-time grief and uproar had actually been very good for us, and that without this experience, AA's 12 Traditions could never have been written. And I felt still better when I heard that by 1950, most of those woes were things of the past, and that the 12 Traditions had been adopted unanimously at the International Convention in Cleveland in 1950, when Dr. Bob made his final appearance and spoke so confidently of his faith in AA's future. On Sunday morning, the last day of the convention, I found those 12 traditions still on my mind. Each of them I saw is an exercise in humility that can guard us in everyday AA affairs and protect us from ourselves. If AA were really guided by the 12 traditions, we could not possibly be split apart by politics, religion, money, or by any old-timers who might take a notion to be big shots. With none of us throwing our weight around in public, nobody could possibly exploit AA for personal advantage, that is sure. For the first time, I saw AA's anonymity for what it really is. It isn't just something to save us from alcoholic shame and stigma. Its deeper purpose is actually to keep those fool egos of ours from running hog wild after money and public fame at AA's expense. It really means personal and group sacrifice for the benefit of all AA. Right then, I resolved to learn our 12 traditions by heart, just as I had learned the 12 steps. If every AA did the same thing and really soaked up these principles, we drunks could hang together forever. I watched as the big hall of the Kiel Auditorium filled up. Thousands of my newfound friends were pouring in for the final wind-up. I caught sight of Father Ed as he eased himself into a seat across the aisle. He was a wonderful reminder of our morning session on the spiritual part of the program. In that session, something happened to me I'll never forget. I had always carried a certain amount of prejudice against churches and clergymen and their concepts of God. Like many AAs, my ideas about God were still mighty vague. But as these two spoke, it had loomed up on me that most of AA's spiritual principles had come to us through clergymen. Without clergymen, AA could never have started in the first place. While I had been nursing my grudges against religion, Father Ed and Dr. Sam had been going all out for us. This was a brand new revelation. Suddenly, I realized that it was high time I began to love them, even as they had loved me and the rest of my kind. When I knew that I could now do this, I commenced to feel warm, clear through. The conviction spread in me that love is a mighty personal thing. Then came the feeling that maybe my Creator really did know me and love me. So I could now begin to love Him, too. This was one of the best things that happened to me at St. Louis. And there must have been a lot of others there who had the same experience. Our last meeting finally began, and it opened with a silence that was charged with confident hope and faith. We knew that ours was a fellowship of the Spirit, and that the grace of God was there. Although these are only words put into the mouth of our created character, Mr. Grassroots, they do represent much of the spirit and the truth that lived in the heart of many an AA as the St. Louis Convention moved toward its culmination. From the Kiel stage, I looked out upon the sea of faces gathered there, and I was powerfully stirred by the wonder of all that had happened in the incredible 20 years now coming to a climax. Had this meeting place been 100 times larger, it still could not have held all of AA's members and their families and friends. Who could render an account of all the miseries that had once been ours? And who could estimate the release and joy that these last years had brought to us? Who could possibly tell the vast consequences of what God's work through AA had already set in motion? And who could penetrate the deeper mystery of our wholesale deliverance from slavery, a bondage to a most hopeless and fatal obsession, which for centuries had possessed the minds and bodies of men and women like ourselves? It may be possible to find explanations of spiritual experiences such as ours, but I have often tried to explain my own and have succeeded only in giving the story of it. I know the feeling it gave me and the results it has brought, but I realize I will never fully understand its deeper why and how. We AAs had tried out a radical and old-time formula, one rather out of fashion nowadays, and it had worked. We admitted that we were powerless, that our lives had become unmanageable, and we made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to God as we understood Him. Every one of us who could make and fairly well maintain this humbling admission and sweeping decision had found relief from obsession and had begun to grow into a totally and wonderfully different mental, physical, and spiritual existence. The thought of Dr. Foster Kennedy crossed my mind. Years ago, this noted physician had asked if one of AA's early friends of psychiatry would come to the New York Academy of Medicine to explain AA to its neurological section. Since several doctors publicly had endorsed us, some in the Saturday Evening Post article of 1941, I thought there would be no difficulty about this, but every one of these medical friends of ours rejected the unusual opportunity. In substance, this was what they said. In AA, we see an unusual number of social and psychological forces working together on the alcoholic problem. Yet, fully allowing for this new advantage, we still cannot explain the speed of the results. AA does, in weeks or months, what should take years. Not only does drinking stop abruptly, but great changes in the alcoholic's motivation follow in a few weeks or months. There is something at work in AA which we do not understand. We call this the X factor. You people call it God. You can't explain God, and neither can we, especially at the New York Academy of Medicine. Such is the paradox of AA regeneration. Strength arising out of complete defeat and weakness, the loss of one's old life as a condition for finding a new one. But we of AA do not have to understand this paradox. We have only to be grateful for it. My mother was there on the auditorium stage, she who had brought me into life 59 years before and who had waited a long, anxious time for a happy fulfillment to my failure-ridden years. Beside her was my wife, Lois, the one who held steadfast when hope had gone, who had attended my second birth and who, in full partnership, had shared with me the pains and joys of our exciting life for the past 20 years. And there sat my sponsor, Ebby, who had first brought the word that lifted me out of the alcoholic pit. Here is a footnote which says that Ebby died in 1966. With the whole convention, I rejoiced that he could be with us, and I thought of many non-alcoholic friends of the very early days. Without them, there could have been no AA at all. They had set us wonderful examples of unselfish devotion. They were the prototypes of thousands of men and women of goodwill who have since helped make our society what it is. One after another, I looked at my friends and fellow workers in AA's headquarters, trustees, directors, staff members, whose dedicated labor had been given for years to To perfect the structure that would now be given into the final keeping of our fellowship itself. Among the crowd in the great Keel Hall, I could see many an old-timer. This had been, indeed, a reunion of the veterans. They had carried the very first torches, and I could feel the deep kinship that will always be something very special among us. I remembered, too, how their ranks had already thinned, and I reflected that in a little more time, all of us who had been pioneers of AA would belong to its past. Suddenly, I was seized with a desire to turn the clock back. I felt a nostalgia for the old days, blending strangely with my gratitude for the great day in which I was now living. Bernard Smith, our chairman, presently summoned me to speak. And with a footnote here, Bernard Smith died in 1970. I recounted and relived the 17-year story of the building of AA's World Service Structure. This talk, together with a full account of our subsequent proceedings on this historic day, may be read farther on in this book. The full attendance of thousands of AAs at St. Louis, representing an accurate cross-section of AA opinion, now sat in convention before us. On the auditorium stage was the Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, about 100 men and women who were the named and chosen representatives of the whole fellowship. The conference, having completed the fifth year of its experimental period with a record of high success, was no longer an experiment. It was the instrument destined to become the heart of AA's third legacy of service and the whole of AA's conscience worldwide. In the simple ceremony that followed, I offered a resolution to the effect that our society should now take its affairs into its own hands, and that its conference ought to become the permanent successor to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Amid a roar of acclamation from the floor, the convention carried that resolution. There was silence, and then we heard Chairman Smith offer the resolution to the conference for its confirmation. A simple show of hands expressed the consent of the conference and marked the exact moment when AA came of age. It was 4 o'clock. An address was then given by Bernard Smith. It had been his skill and devotion that had tipped the scales of opinion among AA's trustees, nearly all of whom had had grave doubts in favor of proposing the conference in the first place. And so we knew that this was as wonderful a day in Bern Smith's life as it was in ours. And now the history-making hours had almost run their course. It remained only for Lois and me to say brief words of farewell. The convention listened affectionately as Lois highlighted some of her memories of other days and gave thanks for the blessings that the years had brought to us. To all present, she was a symbol of what every family under the lash of Barleycorn had suffered. And she was also a symbol of what every united AA family has since found and has become. Lois made us all feel good, clear through. Standing before the convention for the last time, I felt as all parents do when sons and daughters must begin to make their own decisions and live their own lives. No more would I act for, decide for, or protect Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw that well-meaning parents who cling to their authority and overstay their time can do much damage. We old-timers must never do this to the AA family. When in the future they might ask us, we would gladly help them in the pinches, but that would be all. This new relationship was indeed the central meaning of what had just taken place. Like most parents at such an anxious time, I could not resist a few admonitions, which can be read in part 3 of this book. As I spoke, I again felt the tug of that desire to set back the clock. And for a moment, I dreaded the coming change as much as anyone. But this mood quickly passed, and I knew that all worrying concern as a parent was now at an end. The conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous is moved by the guidance of God, could be depended upon to ensure AA's future. Clearly, my job henceforth was to let go and let God. Alcoholics Anonymous was at last safe, even from me. Two, the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. The chief inheritances of the first 20 years of Alcoholics Anonymous are the legacies of recovery, of unity, and of service. By the first, we recover from alcoholism. By the second, we stay together in unity. And by the third, our society functions and serves its primary purpose of carrying the AA message to all who need it and want it. The next section of this volume is based upon three talks given by Bill, a co-founder, at AA's 20th anniversary celebration. The first tells the story of the people and the streams of influence that made AA recovery possible. The second shows the experience out of which the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous were formed, the traditions that today hold AA together in unity. The third tells how Alcoholics Anonymous developed the services that carry its message to the far corners of the earth. The 12 steps. Step 1, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Recovery, the first legacy. We are gathered here in St. Louis to celebrate AA's 20th anniversary. We have come to thank God that He has delivered great numbers of us out of our bondage. We are here to tell AA's innumerable friends of our gratitude for all that they have done to help in this wholesale miracle of recovery, and to share with them and with each other the sure evidence of God's grace among us. Close by many of us this evening are wives, husbands, mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters, those who lived through the dark night of alcoholism with us, those who waited with devotion and hope for a brighter morning to come. Their faith and fidelity at last have been justified, indeed have made this occasion possible. Our gratitude is something none of us can put into words, but we hope all these near and dear ones will realize the full measure of thanksgiving that is in our hearts. We wish to pay tribute to our friends of medicine and religion, whose knowledge, faith, and help without stint were invested in the formation of our society and in its growth in the 20 years just concluded. And we can never forget those couriers for AA, the men and women of the press and of all kinds of communication, who have carried AA's message to alcoholic sufferers and their families. Only God knows the immense amount of misery and death they have averted by telling the story of AA to the world. We are gathered in St. Louis for yet another purpose, which is to declare that AA has come of age. We are not claiming that we have finally grown up, but we are here to consider what our 20 years of experience has taught us, what are the legacies of this experience, and what are the responsibilities toward the preservation of this treasured inheritance. We are here to review the knowledge we have gained of how to recover from our illness, how to stay together in unity, and how to serve by carrying the AA message to all those who still suffer this strange and deadly malady of alcoholism. It is traditional in Alcoholics Anonymous that we do not make speeches. We just talk about our own experiences and about the experiences of those around us. My talk will be no exception. About the middle of the summer of 1934, I lay in Charles B. Towns Hospital on Central Park West. I had been there before. I had met dear old Dr. Silkworth. He had thought at one time that I might recover, but I had gone steadily downhill, and now I lay upstairs in the hospital, knowing for the first time that I was utterly hopeless. Lois was downstairs, and this kind old doctor was trying, in his gentle way, to tell her the bad news that so many wives and husbands have received. He was trying to tell her what was wrong with me, and that I was hopeless. And Lois was exclaiming, "But Bill has a tremendous amount of willpower. You never saw such an obstinate man when he sets his heart on something. He has tried desperately to get well. We have tried everything. Doctor, why can't he stop?" The gentle little man explained that my drinking had become an obsession, a true insanity that condemned me to drink against my will. And she said, "Doctor, what can we do?" So he had to tell her that I would have to be locked up, or go mad, or die. Upstairs, I knew the story. It was the end of a long road. For the benefit of our friends who may not yet know how alcoholics get that way, let me go back to the time when I was a child, the time when I acquired some of the traits that had a lot to do with my insatiable craving for alcohol. I was brought up in a little Yankee town of about 50 houses, East Dorset, Vermont. I was born under the shadow of a mountain there called Mount Aeolus. An early recollection is one of looking up and seeing that vast and mysterious mountain and wondering what it was and whether I would ever climb that high. But I was presently distracted by my aunt, who, as a fourth birthday present, made me a plate of fudge. For the next 35 years, I pursued the fudge of life and quite forgot about the mountain. When I was 10, I went to live with my grandfather and grandmother. They were wonderful old-fashioned Yankees, a breed nearly extinct today. I was tall and gawky, and I felt pretty bad about it because the smaller kids could push me around in quarrels. I remember being very depressed for a year or more. And then I began to develop a fierce resolve to win. I resolved to be a number one man. My grandfather came along one day with a book, and he said, "This is all about Australia. It says that nobody but an Australian bushman knows how to make and throw the boomerang." "Oh," I thought to myself, "here's my chance. I will be the first man in America to make and throw a boomerang." Well, any kid could have a notion like that. It might have lasted 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks. But mine was a power drive that kept on for 6 months, and I did nothing else during all that time but whittle on those infernal boomerangs. I sawed the headboard out of my bed to get just the right piece of wood, and out in the old workshop at night by the light of the lantern, I whittled away. And finally, sure enough, I made a boomerang that swung around the churchyard in front of the house and almost hit my grandfather in the head when it came back. Emotionally, I had begun the fashioning of another sort of boomerang, one that almost killed me later on. In that early period, I had to be an athlete because I was not an athlete. I had to be a musician because I could not carry a tune. I had to be the president of my class in boarding school. I had to be first in everything, because in my perverse heart, I felt myself the least of God's creatures. I could not accept this deep sense of inferiority, and so I did become captain of the baseball team, and I did learn to play the fiddle well enough to lead the high school orchestra, even though it was a terribly bad band. I was the leader, and lead I must, or else. So it went. All or nothing. I must be number one.